Highest and Elaborate Treatise Concerning Prayer and the Answer of Prayer by John Brown of Wamphree, worth chapter 9. This chapter is on the causes to averseness to prayer. Remember, of course, Brown, at the beginning of the book, presents us with John 14, 13 and 14, whatsoever you shall ask in my name, that will I do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you shall ask anything in my name, I will do it. So, Brown, in this chapter, wants to talk about why it is, and this really considering all that we've covered. We understand it's a duty, we understand there are benefits, but we should. We understand it's a peculiar duty to believers. Why is it that there still remains in people this hesitance or reluctance to pray? What causes this in people? And so we're going to see as we go, he's not so much concerned, and we'll see this in one of the early points here, he's not so much concerned about discussing unbelievers. That's not the mystery, that's not something that he's concerned to remedy. But those who profess to be believers, those who are in fact believers, still very often struggle with this duty of prayer. So he wants to address that and try to provide what he understands to be some remedies. Things to that will make it easier. So we're going to look at a number of things. First of all, we're going to look at the keeps them for this averseness, and he's going to then, as we finish up this chapter, he's going to list a number of evils. And his reason for bringing these evils forward that he thinks bring this averseness to the duty of prayer is he wants to give you a proper understanding of what ought to motivate you, why you should be motivated to prayer. So, we're going to be looking at the general, and then these general causes, and then these specific evils that he sees, and the general causes are really more of a diagnosis. The specific evils are being set forth as a spur or a series of spurs to spur you on, you know, to encourage you to this duty of prayer. Because ultimately, one thing that we should understand as believers, the best way to go about a duty is to go about it not with this feeling of constraint, but going about it willingly. You know, actually wanting to do it, desiring to do it, not only because we perceive benefit to ourselves, but ultimately because we have as our goal giving glory to God, the augmentation of the declarative glory of God. That should be really the thing to which we aspire, is to glorify God in our bodies and in our spirit. Right, that we should seek to glorify God in the totality of our being. And this duty of prayer is in fact a duty that contributes to this declarative glory, to the expansion of this declarative glory. It has, as do so many things for those who are in covenant with God, it has a number of blessings that accrue to believers who are diligent in this duty. And we see in that, we really should perceive in all of this, that God's way of dealing with his people is not the same as he's dealing with the heathen. The heathen are really under the continual threat of the rod, the curse. And eternal condemnation. But believers are being led forth in a different way. And they're being led forth in a way of promise. It's, you know, it's the carrot rather than the stick. That's not to say that believers don't receive chastisements in this life. But even those chastisements are received or should be received with an attitude and understanding that ultimately there is greater benefit or blessing that is going to follow, that's somehow enfolded in that. Right? That the end of all of this is God intends to bless his people ultimately by bringing us to glory. And so when we look at these evils, these things that I think of here as spurs, and he's not necessarily going to call them that, but these things which should kind of prod us or goad us on, we should look at them and see them as being so many things set in our paths or in our lives, not to discourage us, but as Brown is really going to point out, to encourage us to pray. And in fact, I think as we get through this, one thing that you should keep in mind, one thing that is alluded to from time to time, is this idea that much of what happens in our lives is actually to that end, to encourage us to seek communion with God. So, let's begin with question 185. What are the two things then that Brown seeks to address in this chapter? So the first thing, Brown wants to inquire into the causes of the unwillingness or aversion of heart to perform the duty of prayer. That's what I said. He wants to address in generalities, but he's going to address that first. And then second, or B, he wants to mention some motives that would serve to animate and encourage set the people of God on that cheerful and ready course to pray. And that's really where these evils will come in. So, um, the first thing that he notes about those averse to the duty of prayer, 186. Is he says, you know, with regard to to those who are strangers to God, he says there's not really much need to inquire into the causes of their unwillingness, right? Because for example, he quotes from Job 21, 14 and 15. They say unto God, depart from us, for we desire not the knowledge of thy ways. What is the Almighty that we should serve him? What profit should we have if we pray unto him? So, Brown sees this as just, I think, par for the course if you're an unbeliever. And of course you're going to be averse. Of course you're going to be unwilling to pray. That isn't really a question, or shouldn't be a question, shouldn't be something that we're trying to figure out. It's frankly the natural state of the fallen man. Right? Natural man is enmity. He's in a state of war with God. So, of course, they're not going to want to pray to God. They're not interested in God. They're hostile to God. And that hostility, he points out, is that they're set against God and his people. Now, 187, what seems strange about this when speaking of God's own children is, he says, seeing that they not only have been made partakers of the divine nature, but have received of the Spirit of Christ, whereby they cry, Abba, Father. He says, this actually is strange, that they should need spurs to this duty. After all, he says, they've received a spirit of prayer. Right? When they received the new nature, they should have received a spirit of prayer. They want to cry out, Abba, Father. So, in order to answer this, he wants to take notice of what he calls three general causes that this occurs in believers. So, this is the case, and we're looking at the case of believers in this chapter in particular. Right? We're really concerned with the averseness to prayer in believers. There's no mystery, and frankly, there's no remedy for unbelievers apart from them coming to faith in Christ. Like, there's not going to be a clearing of this for them. So let's begin to look at these three general causes. 188, the first general cause that may lead to this and he says the first general cause is it may be, he says, there's a supreme overruling hand of God, and God may, for holy and wise ends, withdraw or withhold his spirit whenever he pleases. He's, after all, in Psalm 51:12, he's called a free spirit. So he's saying God sometimes with withholds, withdraws influences of grace, and that certainly could be a general cause. And he does also point out that this general withholding might be because he's been provoked to this by their sinful miscarriages. So, for example, when David falls into sin, or it may simply be a manifestation of his sovereignty and the freedom of his grace, whereby he's going to instruct everyone to know that it is a matter of grace, free grace, and that everyone should be humbled by that. So that he says is the first general cause, is the overruling hand of God, the sovereign hand of God. The second general cause, 189. The second general cause, he points out, is the hand of Satan. We have to remember Satan is a restless, malicious enemy who is going about daily seeking whom he may devour. There is a continual pressing of this wicked work against the people of God. And so as much as he can do, he points out, you know, Satan's going to try to raise every kind of opposition to praying that he can. So he's going to fill your mind with clouds and darkness. He's going to make he's going to make a number of things happen around you, perhaps, or introduce thoughts that will make you prejudiced against praying. And he's going to blow the coal of your own corruptions, right, to discourage you from the duty of prayer.
Is it any coincidence where sometimes when someone actually starts seriously praying, things get a lot harder for them? Like the sins that they struggle with, they're praying again, become inflamed because they're actually trying to stamp them out?
Yeah, I would think that you need to be, you almost need to double down, don't you?
Because yeah. Like if there's some specific sin that you're actually praying against, that then you should expect it to get a lot worse because you're literally
probably, I would say not only that sin, but sin in general in your life. You're sort of calling
you're calling it out.
You're calling it out, and
you're declaring war against it. So you should expect
And Satan is going to engage in that war. Right? Satan is not he's not standing down. He's not taking a back seat in all of this. He's actively trying to trip you up, which is the point. Again, remember we're talking about believers here, right? He's so we understand he's limited as to what he can do with those who have genuine faith. Nonetheless, he's willing to work with what he can. You know, he seems quite happy to, you know, make saints stumble and fall. And a great way to open the door wider for temptation is to get them to forego praying, get them to forego, you know, little acts of obedience, right? It's as Solomon says in the song It's the little foxes that spoil the vines, right? The little things. You start to fudge little matters. You're going to let yourself slide. A little bit here and a little bit there. Not a big deal. You know, pretty soon these not a big deal things all conspire to large falls into sin. Right? So Satan is very interested in keeping you, if he can't own you, the next best thing is to make you ineffective, ineffectual as a believer. Remember, in this time of apostasy in which we live, the Church of Believers is divided into two classes. Those who are public witnesses for the truth, and those 7,000 haven't bowed the knee to Baal, but nobody knows who they are. You know, and the 7,000 haven't bowed the knee to Baal. While they're known to God, and while I'm not inclined to speak evil of them, from the point of view of Elijah, they are useless. Right? Other than knowing that they are there somewhere. But as far as prosecuting the cause of God and His truth in the present generation, they are useless. So, you know, for those who think that they're reforming within somewhere, you are certainly one of the 7,000 if you are a believer, but you're useless to the cause of God in this generation. Anyway, let's move on to the third general cause. Let me lead to this verse, 190. And this we hinted at, and that's the remnant of corruption that is yet in the best of the saints. Right? And he says it's like tinder when it comes to Satan blowing on sparks. Boy, oh boy, he is just a master at getting a little tinder blown up into a big fire all over again. It's not unusual at all for people who are brought to faith to experience from time to time great crises of faith because of this. You're not wrestling against flesh and blood. There are unforeseen enemies, adversaries. There is a spirit world which is in opposition to everything that you've been called to do and to be if you are called out of darkness into His marvelous light. And there is an opposition that is immediately put to work. So these remnants, or this remnant of corruption, this is all actually, from where we sit, it's a double-edged sword against us, right? Because on the one hand, that remaining corruption is a continual provocation to provoke God to, you know, remove grace, to remove the influences of grace. And it's also that continual tinderbox for Satan to be playing at and trying to reignite. And that's the problem that we have. So those are the general causes, but in order to clear this last point, Brown wants he wants to name some of the evils specifically that bring about this averseness to the duty of prayer. This is 191. And while he's not going to get, you know, he's not getting into specific encouragements to set us about the duty necessarily in this chapter, that's really the next chapter. I think there is, as I mentioned at the beginning, I think there's a reason as we consider these evils to consider them as, in fact, a number of reasons that should spur us on to the duty. Right? When we meditate upon these things, because he's going to mention a number of things that if you're honest, if you are at all self-reflective, if you are at all inclined to not only to be honest with yourself, but to make an honest assessment of your situation before God, these evils that he's going to mention are, in fact, a number of them, anyway, these are things that you're probably going to say sound familiar. If you stop and think a little bit, maybe even on the ones that don't sound quite as familiar, upon reflection, I think you might find that they are reasonably good portrayals of what is the common human condition. Right? So when we talk about this averseness to prayer, and again, keeping in mind that we've narrowed the scope to talking about it in those who are believers, professing believers, and assuming that the Spirit of God is working in you, yet, as Brown has pointed out, you still have this remnant of indwelling sin. You've not reached the state of sinless perfection. You haven't moved on to that. You haven't entered into a state of glory. And that means you're going to be, from time to time, you're going to be opened up to these evils. Right? And that's an important thing to recognize, because each one of these then should be a spur to encourage you to pray. When you think about the seriousness of it and the danger, you know, there's that saying, I'm sure you've heard, that there are no atheists in foxholes. Right? When the bombs are falling, when the shots are being fired, almost everybody starts to pray. Right? That's just the natural response. You know, and they're all, almost all of them, if they're not true believers in particular, they're trying to bargain with God. Okay, so when you hear these things, I'm not saying we should be trying to bargain with God, but it is a call to recognize you're in a foxhole in the midst of a spiritual war, and there's all this fighting going on around you, and there's someone out there, or some ones out there, constantly seeking to throw some kind of accelerant on the fire that's burning in you. Your job is, job number one, with respect to yourself, is to mortify the sin that's in you. Right? That Satan and the demons, they're out there trying to get that flame burning again and get it really hot. And so there's this continual fighting. Right? So just keep this in mind as we go through these things. So there are 13 evils that he's going to list. I don't know if he stopped at 13 because it's one of those numbers that is associated in the Bible with bad outcomes, but anyway, he's found 13 things. All right, 192 then. What's the first evil that brings an aversion to the duty of prayer? So he says this, when some lust or other has got advantage, when it's not been carefully withstood and resisted, he says, then the heart is made more unfit for any Christian work. And so you have this corruption in you. You're supposed to be mortifying it. But let's say you don't. You are feeding it. You're giving it advantage. If you want to know, again, why the Puritans were so circumspect about what they put before their eyes and their ears, and why they were so careful in the way they conducted their lives, they knew that the power of sin is great, and they didn't want to give any lust an advantage. Because when the power of the heart, he says, is under any lust, it's carried away with lust, then you are in a captivity. You're not going to do your duty to God as you ought. And he points out, when David was under the power of that corruption and carried headlong with the swing of it, he wasn't his own man. So consequently, you know, are you going to pray? Maybe. Are you going to pray with pleasure and delight? Probably not. You don't want to have lust having an advantage. And the second evil that brings averseness, 193, he says, and this is, I think, related to previous one, he says, but after committing to some sin or giving way to some corruption, the conscience is very often awakened, and the guilt of sin is presented, and that makes the man fearful, afraid to draw near to God. So, in essence, he's saying, look, when you sin, when you are not careful about your behavior, what you're doing is you're setting up yourself for a crisis of conscience. And Satan is going to use that. He's going to come to you and he's going to accuse you and say, God doesn't want to hear you, God isn't going to hear your prayer. What's the point? So you're going to be battling a guilty conscience. And he points out the hard part here is it's actually the duty of the Christian by faith to seek forgiveness, right? To wash away that iniquity. But that guilt of conscience can be paralytic. Says that you know, is very often only broken by God opening a door of grace again. It's very hard to get around that. And so these first two, he's telling you on the one hand, you know, why you should be mortifying the lust of the flesh, and second, you know, the danger of committing sin, you know, when you know, doing that which you know to be wrong. You're putting yourself in a very bad place. All right, the third evil that brings into verse is the duty of prayer, 184. This one is, I think, an interesting one, and one that I'd say is sort of a temptation at the other extreme. Now he's going to talk about some other extremes. You know, when we're talking about extremes in the life of the believer, and this is exactly, I think, why the Bible says, you know, things like don't be righteous over much. And the reason is this third evil. He says a deep apprehension of our own unworthiness or vileness. The inward abominableness of the heart. If you are become, in the course of meditating on that, if you become forgetful, not minding the free grace found in Christ, that you're going to have a fear of this duty. And he quotes Shall or dare such a vile wretch as I, that I am, presume to open my mouth to God? That's sort of the way they're thinking. And he says that it's sort of like that the person who sees so much wickedness in his own heart that he questions, is brought in Habakkuk 1:13. If he can draw near to him who is of pure eyes, then he can behold evil. Or Peter in Luke 5:8 saying, depart from me, for I'm a sinful man, O Lord. That kind of idea, where you gain this very deep apprehension of your own unworthiness. And the danger again is an extreme. Well, it's despair, but the extremity of it is you're meditating on that without at the same time keeping in mind that there is grace through Christ, right? That there is a remedy. It's, yes, you're unworthy, but there's a remedy.
Pious. too much piety?
Yeah, well, that's what I say. This is almost an opposite extreme of what he was just talking about in the first two. These are people who were are inclined to. I think the term, one of the terms that I've read Puritans use for this sort of thinking is morbid introspection. You know, where there's, you know, look, let's be clear, you can't really damn yourself enough before God. But if you don't perceive there's a covenant of grace,
damning yourself without faith is what's wrong.
Right. That's an act. Ultimately, it's actually an act of unbelief. Right? But it may not seem that way, right? If you're in that position, you may perceive yourself to be extremely humble. Or others might perceive you to be extremely humble. Now, there's a problem. And I'll tell you one way I think you can perceive this problem in yourself and avoid this evil. You need to ask yourself, when you read the Bible, does God appear to you to be a God more inclined to wrath or more inclined to mercy? You know, I mean, you can read the Bible and see the wrath of God everywhere, and you shouldn't miss that. That's a different problem. But it is a problem that some people have, that they very easily perceive, you know, this, the holiness of God and their own, which is really getting us to our next point, but they perceive their own unworthiness. We're worms of the dust and all of that. True. We are before God. That should not be allowed to overmaster the covenant of grace.
It's kind of like the people, all these heretics who take one verse and exalt it above another, and they don't weigh the two, correct?
Yeah, it's always this way. Every error, and especially every heresy, right, is it almost always involves exalting one truth in the Bible to the exclusion of another truth. I think I've talked about this before, but when we go back to those early heresies, you know, you had one side who wanted to exalt Christ's divinity over his humanity, to the point where they, you know, suppressed his humanity. That's one kind of heresy. And others who were exalting his humanity and disparaging his divinity. That's another kind of heresy. Is he a true man? Yes. Is he true God? Yes. You know, they both have a point, right? But when you stick to one point in this question, and you miss the other, you're a heretic. And that's, I'm not going to say in this case there's heresy here, but it's a great evil. Right? It's not quite the same thing. This is more of a practical evil people fall into.
When you see judgment everywhere but not mercy in Christ.
Yeah, and that's exactly it, because you perceive everything in terms of your own unworthiness. By the way, that's actually supremely selfish. Right? It really is, because you are making your own unworthiness the standard for interpreting the Bible and the mercy of God. All right, let's move on to the fourth evil that brings in a verse in the Duty of Prayer, 195. The fourth is, and I started to kind of allude to this, deep apprehensions of the greatness, holiness, purity, justice, and glory of God have the same effect. Right? Especially when they're accompanied with what we just talked about in point three, evil three. So boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, right? You know that God is a great and wonderful God, and you have your heart is just dancing for joy at this idea, and you join to it, you know, that apprehension. It's a double whammy. You know, it's like getting hit with a double barrel, you know, evil. You know, again, the issue here is particularly with people who lose sight of the covenant of grace, because those two things, you know, the more you're focused on those two things, the bigger that gap is going to get between where you are and where God is. You know, who you are and who God is. And that's going to make you, I would actually say, not just averse to prayer, you know, go back to what you just mentioned, that you're going to become despairing of prayer. You're just going to despair. I don't see how you can do anything else other than despair in that situation. In the one case, you're digging a hole and you're putting yourself in it deeper and deeper and deeper. The other case, you've got this pedestal that you're jacking up higher and higher and higher and higher.
As you're sinking lower and lower and lower.
And yeah, when they're combined, as I say, it's a double blast from the shotgun of evil. But that's not to say, again, in either case, that the one or the other is not true. Which is why, you know, I say this is, in a sense, at the other end of the spectrum. Because these kinds of things now, these two evils, are things which, at least on the surface, they don't, it's not like I'm giving advantage to a lust, at least not initially as I think about it. I'm damning myself, right? I'm not capitulating to some kind of sin, at least not, I think, as people generally tend to think of sin or conceive of sin. What could be so bad about having great and high thoughts of God, or having low and disparaging thoughts of myself? The answer is a lot if you don't have, in this process of meditation, you don't have a firm grasp of the covenant of grace. You can get carried away in one direction or the other or both. And the net result is it's going to discourage you from praying. All right, 196, the fifth evil that brings an averseness to the duty of prayer. He says that when people on one occasion or other give way to the neglect of the duty, their praying frame wears off. And what he's talking about is this. the more you neglect praying, or the longer you neglect praying, the more
unfit you become.
Yeah, you become unfit, and he says again, there are a couple of things that are going to happen here, probably, right? You're provoking the Lord to withdraw his influences, and you're also opening up the door. Satan's going to take up the opportunity to get in there. And interestingly enough, he brings up the case of Jesus that night in the Garden of Gethsemane, when he is continually going to the disciples and asking them to, you know, to watch and pray. And each time they neglect this duty, they become more unfit, and they become more unfit, and they become finally most unfit.
And then they desert Christ.
And then that's really what happens.
Until, right? God graciously opens a door and restores them, correct?
Yeah.
But that doesn't excuse their duty. That's the mercy of God and his providence.
Right. His point here is that there's, you know, there is this sort of, there's a downward direction when you're neglecting prayer. All right. The sixth evil that brings an averseness to your prayer, 197. It says, when people don't take care to watch over their heart in prayer, when they're not careful to guard against carnality and formality. Right? That there's a seriousness that he says wears away. And formality is praying just sort of by rote. Carnality is praying without a proper framing of the heart toward God. And both of them are...
The carnality, would that be like praying for something but not really thinking that you need it, just praying because, you know, our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Or it would be that there isn't any lifting up of the soul in prayer.
Yes, yeah. There's, you know, there is that rote aspect to it. And he's saying that when this, you know, when this sets in, it's usually not far that neglect of the duty is going to follow. He's saying when you begin to think that way, when you begin to approach it that way, it's really, you're doing it in a sense to be fashionable, and it is not ultimately, you're not viewing it as something necessary. So it becomes, you know, it moves from that to being optional, and it just falls into disuse. Yeah.
So what was the Pharisees' type of praying then? Was it both?
Formality.
Obviously it was formality, right?
There's a lot of formality going on. All right, the seventh evil that brings verses to the prayer, 198. The seventh evil, he says, is, in fact, carnality and worldly mindedness, which is an enemy to all religious duties, it's a great enemy to prayer and a praying frame. So when you are your heart is overcharged with feasting and drunkenness and cares of this life, you can't watch and pray. When you are in that frame, he says, you're entirely indisposed to the kind of watchfulness that prayer is meant to be.
So this is, we've read books before where there's accounts of people who are able to pray for hours and hours and hours. So it's sort of the ability to be able to focus on the prayer that you're offering up and not continually drifting off to, you know, this thing or that thing, what I read in the news, what I heard the neighbor say.
And your particular need for it. Like, you see you need it.
Okay, so, yeah, you and this is really a problem. I don't know. I don't know how pervasive the problem was in Brown's day, but there's probably something akin to this. That is, we live in a time and a place where we are constantly being inundated with, you know, information. And that information is certainly able to clutter our thinking. And you find yourself, just when you hear about something again and again and again, you find that just with news, for example, sometimes it's hard to put something out of your mind. Because it's just repeated so often. Well, what's in view here is, if we didn't have the news, let's say, and for people who don't pay attention to the news, they have other things that they put in that, right? Sports. Or, you know, maybe it is your work, right? Maybe it is eating and drinking, partying, having a good time, whatever. That all these things are so many things that are binding you to this world and making you ill-prepared and unprepared to that spiritual mindedness which is necessary for genuine communion with God. When you pray, by yourself, and you should, you should begin really by trying to clear your mind of everything.
Which is why it's usually good to do it first thing in the morning before you start the day.
As he said, he wants, you know, it should be the first thing you do, and it should be the last thing you do. And, you know, frankly, the more you try to do, the more you ought to be praying throughout the day.
Like, didn't David say he prayed like 7 times a day?
Yeah, there's reason to pray, but, you know, when we were talking about family prayer before, when he's talking about morning and evening, but he's talking, I mean, we're talking about, and he quotes it actually in this point, be careful for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God, Philippians 4:6. Right? We're to make known our requests to God in everything, and our thanksgiving to God in everything. So there are a number of different ways that we're going to pray. We're going to pray, we're going to pray in very focused ways. We should throughout the day. But there are going to be other times we're going to pray short, and we'll talk about this later, I believe, in the book, ejaculatory prayers, where we're just, it's a short prayer.
So, like, in the morning you pray for the grace throughout the day, and then during the day you pray for the continued grace.
There are things that come up.
You pray for the forgiveness for the things that you messed up.
You're actually, in some respects, you're probably better equipped at the end of the day to give thanks.
Mm.
Right? In the beginning of the day, it's sort of like, I think it was Brown of Haddington who noted that it's a bigger sin to neglect praying after the meal than to pray before the meal, because before the meal you're asking God to bless it to you. Afterward, you're returning thanks to Him for the meal. And he said that you're withholding the returning of the blessing to God, which is actually a bigger and more egregious sin in all of this.
So that's the reason why God blesses, right? So we can return thanks.
So anyway, we have to watch out. Carnality and worldly mindedness. And again, this is exactly why the Puritans were so careful and were so eagerly circumspect about what they permitted, what they tolerated in their society. All right, eight. The eighth evil that brings averseness to the duty of prayer is excessive grief and sorrow. It says that excessive grief and sorrow very often unhinges, discomposes, and disframes the soul, so that you can't mind the duty of prayer. And he says, very often excessive sorrow makes you sleepy. Again, that's not a good frame for praying. So these are all important things to keep in mind. And, given the world in which we live, not only do we worry about this carnality and worldly mindedness, but there are plenty of things happening which could bring us to grief and sorrow. And we have to be careful that we're not grieving or sorrowing over much. It's disconcerting and discombobulating. Right, ninth. The ninth evil that brings averseness to the duty of prayer, number 200, is by not watching the prayer. That is, by not taking hold of all of the opportunities for prayer and the free and gracious motions of the Spirit. In other words, what he's saying is, you should be very much open to the motions of the Spirit. If God moves you to pray, you should pray. If you reject that, if you push that aside, what you're doing is, you are provoking the Spirit to withdraw. And if he withdraws, there's going to be a deadness that's going to follow. So, it may seem, and I'll tell you, a lot of times people don't pray in situations because I suspect they would be embarrassed. They would feel embarrassed, or they
like praying in public for their food or something.
It could be that, but it could be something else. You know, I know that in going about and doing things in my trade, there were times when I had things that I needed to do, and I stopped and just, I would pray before I did it. Once in a while, people would ask me, what are you doing? And I would just stop and put my head down. And he said, I'm praying. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm about to do something I know not what, and I needed wisdom. You know, I need to understand it. And, you know, I would tell you, every time I did, the result was actually quite good. Anyway. But, you know, not just those situations. He's really saying, here he points to pray without ceasing, and everything give thanks, quench not the spirit. You know, we have to be in a praying frame always. So whenever the Spirit is moving you to pray, pray. You know, it's not saying that if you're driving a car, you should close your eyes and not off the road, but you know, you can pray. You can still pray. All right, the tenth evil that brings in verses to the duty of prayer, 201. And he says, this is an evil that flows from pride or pettiness, but he says, when a person has been praying for some considerable time, for a special mercy, or for something that he wants, and he gets no return or satisfaction, then he says very often this starts to boil up in the heart. And the moment that becomes discernible in the person, the one who's going to discern it is probably, he says, going to be Satan, who's then going to be suggesting to you it's a vain exercise to pray. Right? Why bother? And that that is a big problem. Frankly, if you've been praying for a long time for something and you don't get it, you need to ask yourself if you're praying according to the will of God. If you are, then you should keep praying. Right? But maybe you're not, and maybe that's what you should be trying to discover, rather than allowing yourself to fall into this trap of being tempted to think that praying is, you know, of no use. It will come to nothing. Right? God will never answer, you know, my prayer.
As long as it's according to the will, it needs to be prayed all the time. Like for parents who have unconverted children, that they always be praying for their children to be converted, even if it takes a long time, correct? That's something you're good to keep praying for, but maybe the job you want, you know, your dream job, you keep praying for it, it doesn't come.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Other some of these things, other doors open. Right, other things happen while you're praying in one particular direction, and then all of a sudden things, you know, start to unfold in a way that you could not have fathomed. The problem is, if you're so focused on what you believe is going to be the answer, and it's not something, specific. You know, it's one thing if you're praying for something that God has promised specifically. Right, and that you should be persistent in that. But if you're praying for something and you're not sure it's the Lord's will, you should begin to inquire whether it is God's will. A and B, if you have reason to believe it is God's will, then you need to maybe inquire whether it's God's timing, or or whether or not, although it may be within the will of God, maybe there are other options, right? I think, again, sometimes, this is what he's talking about here, is we want X. We want that thing, right? And that's the only thing we want now. You know, it's like a kid who wants some toy. And, you know, you could give that child every other toy in the store, and they don't care. They're not going to pay attention. They're going to throw fits because he didn't get that toy, right? The one toy. And that's what he's saying. There's pride. There's a pettiness about people in this. And sometimes God doesn't answer your prayers, and it's a blessing. You know, and you'll find out in time why. And you'll find out that there is a blessing to that. Right? So to conclude then that I shouldn't pray, why bother? That's the wrong conclusion. You shouldn't fall to that conclusion. A couple more. The 11th evil that brings aversion to the duty of prayer, 202. It says, there's an erroneous opinion that people have, and I'm not sure this is something that I tell you what it is, if you've read the Puritans much, you can see that they place a fair bit of weight on this. But let me tell you what Brown says, and then I want to make a point. He says this, that we're not obliged to pray unless we're sensible of the Spirit moving us to pray. Right? And the Puritans do talk about this a lot, you know, that you should seek a spirit of prayer, that you should this is a very desirable thing, to be sensible of the motions of the Spirit of God in prayer. But what Brown is saying is that is not the limitation, right? As desirable as it may be, this is one of these things where, you know, you should pray regardless of whether or not you feel like it. And in fact, he says that you know, neglect of prayer leads to that feeling or lack of feeling like praying. And I don't feel like praying. Whereas on the other hand, you know, you do pray, that in, you know, in time, in most cases, in time, you actually probably will begin to, you know, have that. But that, just because you don't feel like praying, that's not a good reason not to pray. Right? And you shouldn't use, he's saying, don't use that as an excuse. All right, the 12th evil that brings a verse in the duty of prayer, 203, is when there's a spirit of laziness. You know, you don't give yourself over to stirring up yourself to call on the Lord. And so he says, daily, become more and more unfit for the duty. He says it's spiritual sloth. Brown is saying, you know, you can protest all day long, I'm not a lazy person. Brown is saying, yes, you are. If you don't pray, you're lazy.
He's not really talking about the just like the quick prayers throughout the day, but that specific setting apart of time each day
to
pray.
He's talking about setting apart time. He's talking about there's a lot that he thinks should go into prayer, which he's going to get into a little bit later in the book, but he wants you to be actively engaged, right? Not drawing back, but he knows you have to get yourself kind of worked up to it. And it really, his point on this one is, you do this for other things. You know, you get yourself roused up. You get yourself together. Do other things that you want to do or need to do. He's saying, you know, same thing here.
So you think it's not just the laziness where it's, oh, I don't feel like specifically praying right now. Of course, that's tied up in it. But even like the, I'm going to take 5 minutes before I pray and clear my mind, put my phone away, put my things away, that kind of thing. Just
yeah, he's really indicting the whole. I would say the whole series of activities that you're going to have to engage to do to pray right. You have to deliberately set apart time, you know, put things out of mind, focus. He's talking about set times of prayer, let's say. But he's not, even though he's getting at that, I don't think he's excluding other times or kinds of prayer. Because, let's face it, people who set apart times to pray in the day are probably going to be more willing to pray at different times during the day. You know, and it goes back to I think I've mentioned this idea before, but there's a question, I forget who it was now, but the question was to the effect of may I may I eat while I pray, let's say. And the answer is absolutely not. Right? But then the question is, well, can I pray while I eat? And the answer is, well, of course you can. Right? So, there are clearly times that are to be set apart for praying, specifically for that purpose. But that does not exclude or preclude the need or the usefulness of praying, you know, throughout the day, no matter what you're doing.
Like we talked about a few moments ago, that if you feel like you're being compelled by the Spirit.
Yeah, you really, you know, you, for whatever reason, I mean, you know, I can think of an example, a recent example, when I was just sort of standing somewhere, gazing off, and then I had this overwhelming sense that I should be praying, and I did, and, you know, there was, it turned out that it was specific, and it turned out, you know, 15 minutes later I realized why. All right, 13th evil that brings an averseness to the duty of prayer, 204. This comes when people lean more to a gift of prayer than to Jesus for present influences and supplies. This is always a problem. You know, there are people who are particularly gifted in prayer. And like any gift, there is always the danger that you allow yourself to become fixated on the gift rather than the gift giver. And that's going to be a deadening, dampening and deadening effect. So, knowing who we are and what we are, these things are all, I think they should all be so many spurs. But Brown, in the next chapter, is actually going to go over a number of encouragements and add to them. So in chapter 10, we'll be looking at a series of encouragements. That'll be next.